Today on Straight Talk Africa, a huge gathering of Americans turned out in Washington, D.C. Saturday for the anniversary of the Million Man March. 20 years ago, among those who attended that rally was a young African-American state senator from Illinois. Today, Barack Obama is president of the United States. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. It's Wednesday, October 14th. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Mariama Diallo, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll talk about the significance of the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, we'll share your thoughts on this important and timely topic through your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments. Hope you'll stay with us.
Thanks, Mariama. But first, 20 years after the historic Million Man March, the turnout was smaller, but the spirit and message much the same. My colleague, Paul Sisko, has more.
Tens of thousands, mostly African men and women, gathered at the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Saturday, waving flags, carrying signs, and hearing speeches. On the anniversary of the 1995 Million Man March, like 20 years ago, the call is for change in policing, social justice for black and minority communities, and equal justice under the law. On October 16, 1995, Reverend Louis Farrakhan, having organized civil rights groups and activists, attracted several hundred thousand people to Washington to raise awareness of the many social injustices facing the African-American community. At the time, African-Americans faced unemployment rates nearly twice that of white Americans and a poverty rate of more than 40%. In 20 years, the percentage rate of blacks living in poverty in the United States has declined. But the unemployment rate of African Americans remains almost twice that of whites. Many of the same messages heard 20 years ago resounded Saturday.
There needs to be a spiritual and mental awakening. That has taken place. And 20 years later, now we're poised, and the message is justice or else. So now it's going to be an economic, a physical, and a political awakening that will be taking place.
There's still people dying in the streets, you know? We still have to do stuff like this, you know. We still have to chant Black Lives Matter. We still have to turn on the news every day and see another one of us dying in police brutality.
20 years ago, we did not have, as much as we today, have a pronounced sense of injustice experience at the hands of the police. It seems that the past 2 or 3 years, that has just been a mainstay within our psyche. My son worries about when a police follows me. He worries about the images that beams across the television, and he's gotten to the point where he says we're watching the news again.
The historic 1995 rally called on African American men to unite in betterment of themselves, families, and communities. This time, Native Americans and men and women of all races and faiths were invited to Washington under the theme, Justice or Else. Organizer Louis Farrakhan told the crowd, "We are still fighting for civil rights.
There must come a time when we say enough is enough."
Like the rally 2 decades ago, the goal for many attendees was to loudly call for justice in the wake of several recent deaths of unarmed African Americans by law enforcement officers. Paul Sisko, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Now, joining us here in our Washington studios, I expected to be 2 distinguished guests. One of them is right here, Douglas Sloan, Executive Committee Member of the D.C. NAACP. He's also the co-founder of the National Capital Strategy Group. And, of course, as I said, we hope to be joined later by Kadiatou Diarro, who is the mother of Guinean Amadou Diarro, an armed West African immigrant killed by 4 New York police officers in February 1999. And she's the founder and president of the Amadou Diarro Foundation. Well, I have to say, Dagaras, finally, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a great honor to be here.
You're most welcome, sir. Later in the program, rather on a programming note, we were supposed to be joined by the South African Institute for Race Relations, but due to circumstances beyond our control, they are unable to do so. Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111, and the US country code is 1. Let me come to you back immediately. Dagaras, how is it, first of all? Did you attend Saturday's event?
Yes, I attended Saturday's event, and I also attended the Million Man March back in 1995.
Very interesting, because what we just heard in the package, actually, was that 20 years ago, there was a young African-American who attended the event and happened to be a state senator in Illinois.
That's right.
And as we talk today, he's doing his second term as president of the United States of
That's
America,
right. Uh-huh.
Staying in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
That's right. That's right. The Million Man March in 1995 attracted black men from all over the country. It actually set a record for attendance of any rally at the National Mall at that time. An independent study was done by Boston University, and they determined that approximately 837,000 people attended that march on October 20th, 1995, and Barack Obama was one of them, as was I.
Really? So talk to us about Saturday. How was it?
Oh, it was great. It was a wonderful experience to see everyone come together in unity and brotherhood as we did in 1995. This march was different. There weren't as many as attendees. It didn't seem to be promoted as well as the march in 1995. And this march was much more inclusive. Mm-hmm. Women were invited. All people of color were invited. They were representatives from the Native American community. There were representatives from the Latino community that were also allowed. They were not only in attendance at the march, but were also allowed to speak at the podium. So this was a much more inclusive event than the march in 1995.
So how come this particular one, as you say, was inclusive, and the other one, in fact, was exclusive to black men? And yet, the first one was much larger than the one of Saturday, 20 years later.
Yes.
Does it that mean that perhaps the conditions have improved? Things have changed or what?
Well, I think you can make an argument on both sides. It's hard to make a statement that things haven't improved when we do have an African-American sitting in the White House, okay, effectively operating as the most important and powerful man on the planet. So you can definitely make the argument that things have improved. I think back in 1995, the state of black America at that time was in turmoil internally. There was many cities and urban centers were struggling with violence and homicides, high homicide rates. And there was a crisis in the black community regarding black men. And Minister Louis Farrakhan decided to call the march and gathering of people, gathering of black men in Washington to focus on our internal struggle for mm-hmm. black men to come together in a sense of atonement, to realize and take responsibility of becoming better role models in mm-hmm. our community, mm-hmm. becoming better fathers, becoming better husbands, becoming better citizens, and taking responsibility for what we do, because we had all of this turmoil within the black community. So I think, and it was the first one of its kind, and so it's often hard to replicate something that like that, that was so grand, that was so massive. And people spoke much longer back then. I believe the speakers went on for 10 hours, you know, and they were, I went down there. I was a student at American University at the time, and I remember I had a class that morning in the mid-morning, and I remember I was a major in, I got my degree in public communications and minor in political science, and so I was in the communications center. Of course, communications center, they have TVs and monitors all over the place, mm-hmm. and I remember looking at the television screen and seeing all of these people gathering on the mall, I was like, oh my God, I better hurry up and get down there. So I raced across campus, jumped in my little car, whatever I was driving at that time, and got down there. And I remember seeing people pouring off the buses that were parked all along Independence Avenue and pouring out of the train station. Union Station is right there on U.S., right near the U.S. Capitol. They were coming from Philadelphia, from New York, from Boston, from Virginia, from all over the place. And so it really was a great gathering. It was a sense of brotherhood there. There was no violence. And, you know, we literally just stood at attention and listened to all of these wonderful speakers over the course of 10 hours. It was amazing. It went until dusk. Mm. So it is really difficult to replicate something like that. But it was a great march. It was something that needed to happen. I can personally attest that I know many people that attended that march who changed themselves in the course of their lives, changed for the better after that march. And like I said, this one is a little bit different because this had an external focus as opposed to an internal focus. The external focus was on, of course, disparate treatment of black men at the hands of the police. So regarding the Black Lives Matter movement. So a lot of this focuses on what can we do to address this, what is becoming a scourge of the black in the black community, you know, disparate treatment and violence against black males in particular at the hands of police, and they discuss different ideas to try to combat that issue that is very prominent in the black community. And to a lesser extent, it also addressed the issue of women's roles within the black community. So that was very good as well.
You talked, of course, about how there have been changes in the last 20 years, and you gave the example of a black man occupying 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Arguably, perhaps the most important political address on this planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you respond to some critics who will say, yes, he may be in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but really you're talking about cosmetic improvements here,
mm-hmm.
cosmetic changes, that what is needed are fundamental changes?
Well, a lot of people like to try and bring that up, and I am a staunch defender of President Barack Obama because in his position he has made a lot of changes to help black people. He's the first sitting president to address criminal justice reform. He visited a prison in the United States just a few weeks ago to tackle the issue of criminal justice reform. He also has addressed the issue of disparate sentences for minor drug offenses, putting nonviolent felons in prison for a long sense of time, and even that's bipartisan agreement on that issue. Even the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, spoke out against that. He is going to be releasing 6,000 people from prison that are nonviolent drug offenders that got caught in that three strikes, you're out rule, that most of those people are black. He also started the My Brother's Keeper initiative, which is focused on young black males tutoring young black children to ensure that they're on the right path. He addressed issues regarding the zero tolerance policy in our public schools, where young black children are being suspended and expelled at higher rates than their white counterparts. He released some of the controls on the Department of Labor so that they can go after discrimination in construction industry and development industry in to not just in different cities, but around the country. So he actually has done a lot for black people in the country, not to mention his signature piece of legislation, which is Obamacare, the health care, which helps people of all races, but also has been a big help to African Americans in this country regarding health care.
I think you're right, Degas. The president has tried, really, to make some contributions. But then how do you explain these voices which keep talking about how black lives matter?
Well, again, that is an issue that, you know, I really can't say that it's a new issue because we've been looking. You mentioned Amadou Diallo's mother, who is supposed to be joining us shortly, who whose son was shot by New York police in the vestibule of his own apartment building, reaching for his wallet. He was shot 41 times. That is inexcusable. That is a horrible abuse of power by police officers operating under the color of the law. And as I recall, those officers were not prosecuted. I think two of the officers did leave the force, but I think the other two officers are still in the force, which is just horrible. So it's not a new problem, but it is a problem that has been brought to the forefront because of the advent of social media and everyone having smartphones like this one here, where it come with video cameras and it come with different photos that you can take advantage of, or rather still shots you can take advantage of. So the fact that everyone has a camera on them now, we are now seeing a lot of these disparate treatment and violence against black males by the hands of the police. And, you know, social media is helping to get that out to the public, the waiting masses through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram. So now we're seeing all this stuff that was likely happening in the dark beforehand. And, you know, it's a good thing, but at the same time, it's an issue that we definitely need to address, and it's not something that's new that's just been happening since Obama's there. It's just now that we are more aware of the problem.
Interesting. Now we'll pause for a short break, and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website Twitter, and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Justice or Eris. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa, become a fan, and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please don't go away.
This year's march comes following the deaths of several unarmed black men at the hands of white police officers from Ferguson, Missouri to New York City. On October 16, 1995, an estimated 1 million black Americans assembled for a peaceful rally on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to demand justice from the U.S. government. On Saturday, October 10th, thousands of black men, women, and children converged once again on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to demand justice from the U.S. government. This year's gathering commemorated the 20th anniversary of the so-called Million Man March, the large peaceful rally of black men inspired by leaders in their black community to take responsibility for their lives, families, and communities.
Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githu, you what? And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from Washington. Now, let me come back to you, Douglas. You remember, of course, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. once said that he had a dream that one day his children would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. How far have we gone along that track?
Well, I will say this about the civil rights movement that was very important. It was very organized, and through the civil rights movement, we were able to get laws enacted, like the Civil Rights Act, that protected the interests of African Americans and other people of color in the United States. And as a result, we are a nation of laws. We are the oldest constitutional republic on the planet. No one has followed the Constitution as long as we have. When we started this country, we followed the Constitution. And as a result, we are very litigious and very lawfully minded. So no matter what, as long as we are following the law, generally you won't have any issues. But if the law is broken, then city, state, local governments will come out to seek to enforce those laws. And I guess what I'm saying is, to come back to it, is that regarding the content of character, we have implemented some laws to ensure that people of color, and African Americans in particular, are not discriminated against based upon their color. And really, the only issue that we are running into now is ensuring that those laws are enforced, and ensuring that when discrimination arises, that it is reported dutifully to the law enforcement officials, and that those that have been discriminatory and engaging in discriminatory practices are prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. So have we gotten past the issue of racism? Of course not. But the fact that we are a country and a nation of laws, and we do have laws on the books to prevent such discrimination, has brought us a long way and has allowed for many people of color, African Americans in particular, to move forward and excel in this country. Perfect example being Barack Obama, the highest law enforcement official in the land now is Loretta Lynch, a black woman. Before that, it was Eric Holder.
That is correct. But then how do you explain or how do you reconcile some of these contradictions, frankly? Because look at Ferguson.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Look at Missouri. Look at Baltimore, New York, and you name it. How do you explain that? And look also at the disproportionate percentage of African Americans who make up the majority of the people in prisons, in jails around the United States of America.
Well, let me address the first one, the first issue regarding explaining a city like Ferguson, Missouri. Quite frankly, it is incumbent upon the citizens, the black citizens in Ferguson, Missouri, to become involved in the democratic process. Ferguson is a majority black city, I understand. I think they're at about 59%, 60 or 62 or 63% black. There is no excuse for there to be white mayors and a white majority city council when you have a black majority city. At that point, it's just a matter of black people becoming involved in the political process, ensuring that they are getting out, that they are involved in issues that affect them, that they are registered to vote, and that they are voting for people that will best represent their interests in those legislative bodies that create the laws by which they all have to live by. In Ferguson, that wasn't the case. I think they had like a 10-member city council, and there was only maybe one black person. I don't recall the numbers. It was like one or zero black people on the council. Now, that has changed. Since Ferguson, they have a Black Lives Matter movement. They did a great thing. They went out there and registered people to vote. If you want, this isn't a monarchy. This isn't a dictatorship. This is a constitutional republic that is operating under the same guiding principles as a democracy. So you can change the situation that you are in. You can change your environment by becoming politically involved. And it's important, it is critical, that we impart that message to African Americans living in these cities where they are feeling oppressed by an oppressive minority in these cities, like in Ferguson. You really can't say it about Baltimore, New York, because those in Baltimore, they do have black city councilmen and black mayors.
Correct. Mayor.
Yeah, a black mayor. But in particular about Ferguson, you know, they have to get in there. Everybody should register to vote. There should be a majority black city council, and there should be a black mayor. And then they should have a black police chief. And then if they have blacks in position of power, they will find that they are much less likely to face discrimination and have those problems and issues. Now, I'm sure if you're out there, if there's crimes being committed, the police are going to enforce the law. But you are at a much, much lower likelihood facing discrimination at the hands of black people, obviously.
I think, of course, you effectively succeeded in explaining some of the things that needs to be done. But how do you, for example, explain the fact that you have a black mayor in Baltimore, you have people voting in droves in New York City, but you still have problems, especially from the police? Well, is it something about police behavior, culture? What is it?
Well, in Baltimore.
And we are even talking about some African-American police officers
involved.
Yeah. But yes. And regarding the issue of Freddie Gray, there were African-American police involved. But regarding, I think if you look at, if you do an average or count of all of the shootings of unarmed black men at the hands of police around the country, you will find that a vast majority of the cops doing that have been white police officers. Now, regarding Baltimore, I will note that the mayor of that city prior to the last mayor was, I believe, well, prior to the mayor, the last two mayors was Martin O'Malley, who was running for president right now. And he did, and I like Martin O'Malley, but he did implement a broken glass policy, which is the same policy implemented by Rudy Giuliani in New York.
What is a broken glass policy?
That means that they will enforce every little issue or law on the books. Spitting, broken glass, jaywalking, any little infringement of the law will be enforced. And in these urban environments, I think it's been demonstrated that that is not the way to police people in urban environments. You know, there are much bigger issues and problems to address than going through getting someone for spitting gum on the ground or, you know, getting someone for breaking glass or something like that. You need to deal with much larger, much more complex issues. But at the same token, you know, since those two new black mayors have come in, Stephanie Rawlings Blake being one of them, I think it is incumbent upon the mayors of these black cities to ensure that, you know, if you have a majority black city, it is generally a good idea that you have a black police force, that the police force reflects the population of the city to ensure that we don't run into these problems. Because what's happening is you have white cops that are coming from suburban and rural environments that have never had to live or deal with people in urban environments, much less deal with black people, and they are just reacting in the wrong way. And so, you know, it's much better practice to have people that are born in urban environments that have a feel for the city out there enforcing laws and dealing with issues that arise in urban environments.
You know, again, I go back to the words of wisdom by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who once said that injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. You said it rightly. We have had for the last 6 years African Americans attorney generals.
That's right.
How come they have not been able to figure out a way of making sure that those words of wisdom by Martin Luther King can actually be applicable, can be applied?
Well, and again, Barack Obama and attorney Eric Holder and now Loretta Lynch have been doing a yeoman's job in terms of implementing laws and practices that are going to filter down. But you also have to understand that Barack Obama is the first black president in our 300-year history since George Washington came on board. And, you know, we are fighting many years of discriminatory practices by police, by law enforcement officials, by government officials, by elected officials. So it's going to take some time to change things around, but I believe that he has made a lot of strides in the right direction, and I applaud him for that.
Very interesting. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, but first here is Mariama Jero. Take it away, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Shaka. Still to come, we'll reveal some of the feedback we've received from our audience through social media. But now, here is our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan who responded to our question of the week. Felix Darius Ngura from Kabale in Uganda writes, "The best answer should be creation. How many creators do we have? Only God. Are we in his image? Yes. So racism and injustice are not godly. We have a moral obligation to do to others what we want them do to us."
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gidiu Uwat, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and media reporter. Take it away again, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Shaka. Tens of thousands of people gathered over the weekend on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. to mark the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March under the theme of Justice or Else. Men and women of different races came to the U.S. Capitol to make the demands, of their federal lawmakers for equal justice under the law and to address the violence that is gripping many black communities. Well, this leads us to our question of the week, which asks, 20 years after the Million Man March, what is the most viable way to confront racial inequality and social injustice? Well, thanks for using all our social media platform to communicate to us. We'll start with your tweets. And let me just remind you that we are tweeting live today. Just use the hashtag VOA Justice or Else. And if you haven't yet, please do follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. And speaking of it, let's go to a tweet from P. Sambatia, who writes, "Yes, I do believe that protests can bring a change, even if the changes haven't been put in place at that time when the government looks in." Not sure really what he's saying here, but maybe he means even when the government basically opposes it. Oh, well. Let's look at another tweet from Ade Weslomo, this time who writes, "I was bitter about the racial activities over there," meaning in the United States, "these days. I really think it serves a good platform to speak out to the world." Well, I think we're going to go now to a Facebook comment from Dr. Lugano Wilson from Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, who writes, "The U.S. government must reenact strict and serious punitive laws against racist individuals such as life incarceration or capital punishment if found guilty. It's unfortunate that racism does not seem to be considered a serious crime. Above all, we are all dumbfounded when it's revealed that police officers are among the perpetrators of such anachronistic racist acts." Well, pretty strong statement there. Your take, Shaka.
Thank you very much, Mariama. How do you react to that, Degras?
I think that regarding some of the violence that we're seeing at the hands of police, again, I think that it's always been there. It's just a matter that now it's cataloged with the advent of social media. And I think that the Black Lives Matter movement has done a great job in terms of addressing that issue and bringing it to the forefront. They've engaged in protests nationwide. There was a question regarding the Black Lives Matter movement in last night's Democratic presidential debate, and all of the candidates had to answer it. So it's obviously a movement that has taken root, that is moving forward, and that is dealing with some of the issues that we're facing and we're dealing with regarding disparate treatment of blacks at the hands of the police.
But how do you explain the fact that when you look at, industrial countries around the world, we can talk about Canada, which is north of us right here, and you compare and contrast with the behavior of the police and the manner in which they are armed, as if, in fact, they were at a war with enemies from another country.
Agreed.
The type of weapons.
Mm-hmm. So, it's unfair to compare Canada to the United States. And I say that because the United States is very different and very unique. This country is fueled with testosterone and aggression. We always have been.
But people are people. Why not use rubber bullets?
Oh, I agree regarding that in terms of The police need to be demilitarized. The Black Lives Matter movement came up with a list of demands, an end game, if you will, in terms of what they would like to see out of this movement. Demilitarization of police forces is one of them, as well as de-escalation training to de-escalate violent incidents instead of being aggressive to address them. So we're seeing, ending of the broken window police policy. So the Black Lives Matter movement has come up with a list of not demands, but a list of issues that they would like to see implemented to try to address this problem that we're having with the police. But a lot of this goes back to the George Bush administration when they engaged in all of these wars. We went over to Afghanistan, we went over to Iraq, we built up our military industrialized complex, and we spent billions, trillions of dollars to build it up. And then we had all this excess machinery left over. And what did they do with all of these vehicles, all of these guns, all of this armor? The Bush administration, in its infinite wisdom, decided to give them to the police forces, which, of course, have no business having tools that you use in forward areas, in wartime arenas, on our community, on American citizens. It absolutely makes no sense whatsoever. So demilitarization of police forces in America is critical.
I will come back to that later, because someone might shoot back and say, what about the history of slavery in this country? In fact, you can compare what used to happen in apartheid South Africa, and you begin to see some similarities there. Mariama, do you have any more feedback to share with us, please?
Absolutely. We'll move on to a posting from Alphonse Priera from London in the UK, who writes, I believe using nonviolent protest is the best way to confront racial injustice and conflict, simply because if you want to achieve peace, you must show it first. Meanwhile, using violence can only mean one thing, which is destruction and damage. It will send the wrong message to the people. Well, let's look at another Facebook comment, this time from Nana Okosua of Geneva in Switzerland, who writes, nonviolent civil disobedience and protest are still the best ways to raise awareness on racial injustice. Applying financial pressure is also one of the best ways to push for change while avoiding unnecessary bloodshed. Well, Shaka and guests, interesting comments this time around. Your take.
Very interesting, Degas, isn't it?
I think that the example was set through the civil rights movement, through Mahatma Gandhi, that nonviolent protests are an effective way to address civil rights issues at the hands of governing bodies and at the hands of the government. We saw it happen. We saw a successful model used in the civil rights movement. And so I think that it is a good idea. And we've seen a lot of that regarding the Black Lives Matter movement as well. We have seen nonviolent protests to address disparate treatment of blacks at the hands of the police. And I would like to see that continue.
By the way, we should point out that police brutality is not limited to the United States, nor is it really an issue of black and white, because the last time I checked, when you look at some African countries, you have that problem.
You do.
For example, the country where you trace your ancestry, Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
I gather that you trace your ancestry back to the Oromos in Ethiopia. Is that correct?
Yes, the Oromo tribe.
And, of course, they have a lot of problems with the police sometimes in Ethiopia. And recently, we saw some incredible pictures coming out of my own country, Uganda. Hmm. Where a lady by the name of Ms. Vatuma, because she belongs to an opposition political party called the FDC, which supports the major opposition leader, a Dr. Chiza Besigye, was going to attend a rally. You can't believe that the police had the audacity to address this lady publicly, as if really it is a crime to own a point of view or an opinion that is contrary to that owned by the sitting government.
Yeah, that is horrible. And fundamental freedoms and right to free speech are something that's guaranteed in this country and should be guaranteed worldwide. You cannot try to suppress someone simply because they have a different viewpoint than you. Everyone's viewpoint should be valid, and to an extent, those viewpoints should be heard, because we all have to live on this planet together, and we can't do that with systems of oppression.
Well, thank you very much, Mariama, for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
Well, that will do it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please keep them coming. If you are a new fan, just drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com, or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa and follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Another reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Just go to the VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website, or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Well, now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, we'll look at the upcoming elections in Africa. We'll also consider what makes an election credible to the extent that it reflects the will of the people. We'll have that discussion and more next week right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back, and today we are talking about the significance of the Million Man March 20 years later. Our distinguished guests are expected, of course, right here in the studio is Kadiatou Diarro, who is the mother of Guinean Amadou Diarro, an armed West African immigrant killed by four New York police officers. And she's the founder and president of Amadou Diarro Foundation. And Dagara Sloan, executive committee member of the DCNAACP, is also the co-founder of the National Capital Strategy Group. A reminder that you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa, and we'll continue our discussion in a moment.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui-Ewart. And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa coming to you live from Washington. I have to say, frankly, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you in the studio for the first time, even though you have participated via telephone link up below.
Yes, it's my honor to be here.
It's a pleasure.
Yes.
Now, you attended, I'm sure, Saturday event, did you?
Yes, I did.
What can you tell us about it? What did you come out with?
It was a very moving moment. I believe we had about over 60 families from every state in the United States here, every west, east, everywhere. Mm-hmm. Families of victims of police violence, police shooting, and at the same time, families of victims of gang-related violence. So we were able to bond and to connect and share about our experiences. We spent like 2 days going through this very wonderful event. I think it's important to remember that 20 years ago, was a defining moment for African-American community and the world at large to teach young people how to be responsible, mm-hmm. How to respect their family, how to have a vision and a purpose. And 20 years later, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan called us and asked us to come back 20 years later. I think if we want to wear into what happened since then, we would see that we have not made progress.
Now, when you look back, Madam, as you said, the first time that such a march, in fact, occurred was back in 1995.
Yes.
And your son was murdered 4 years later, correct?
Yes, yes.
And we still have Ferguson.
Yes.
We still have Baltimore.
Yes.
And in fact, even New York.
Absolutely. We have the Eric Garner case. Mm-hmm. We have Mohamed Ba case, both of whom, one of the case, Eric Garner case, was worldwide focused with the media. Everyone knows about it. But some silent victim will also fall into the hands of the NYPD in New York City. Example, Mohamed Ba from Guinea, like us. And his mom called 911, and the police descended and just killed him. Eric Garner, everybody have seen the video. In 1995, when this march was about to be conducted here in Washington, D.C., my son was in Singapore studying, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and his passion and vision was to come to the United States and get an American degree. And with his dreams, he came here working hard to save money for college, and he was killed. How many victims will have to be like Amadou, like Eric Garner, Sean Bell, and the list goes on. Ferguson, Mike Brown. We met all of us. We are about to have a big connection with just the families to understand that we will not survive by ourselves. We have to help each other. We each family have individual effort that they are doing. Like for me, I created the Amadou Diallo Foundation, giving scholarship to African students, and also advocating for racial healing and police and community relations. And I know my brother here also being involved in this very nice organization, because each one of us have to do what we need to do in order to improve the condition of our human family. Black life matters. All life matters. But we are not there yet.
We agree, of course, that there have been some reasonable improvements since, of course, 1995, especially because there was a young African-American man, mm-hmm. who was a state senator in Illinois, mm-hmm. who happened to be attending that event,
yes.
of 1995. Mm-hmm. And that man, Barack Obama, as we talk, is the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yes.
And we do have an African-American woman.
First lady.
Who is the first lady. Yes. We do have an African-American lady who is the attorney general.
At the Justice Department.
Uh-huh.
So
what is needed, really?
Why still we lagging? We want to celebrate this success. We want to celebrate the president. We want to celebrate the first lady. We want to celebrate our Justice Department Attorney General. But in our own silent pain, we are wondering what needs to happen in order for our youth to be able to pursue their dreams without being harassed, without being profiled. And so they can pursue their success. But it's not happening. Why? I think it has to go back to individual responsibility. Individual responsibility in our homes, in our churches, in our mosques, in our synagogues, everywhere. Because this generation right now, you see how they are galvanized and they are involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. We need to channel that energy and have them to do something positive. Because in the end, we are all into the same vacuum. We have to survive.
Well, I gather that we have to go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Patrick from Nigeria. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Mr. Shaka. Good evening, our guest. My name is Okora for Patrick of Parachuku in Nigeria. Madam Jaloma,
yes.
I want to find out from you what is happening in America today has happened years back. Why is this still happening today? Upon that, Africans in our continent are still rushing to America as hotcakes. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Wow, that's a very profound question. And you see, what the media sell is the dreams, the TV, the hip-hop movement, music, and everything.
Hollywood.
The reality is people dream of coming to the U.S. If you have opportunity, you can succeed. But you have to see the other side of America as well. How many young people are suffering? Look at Baltimore, where Freddie Gray was killed. Many young people capable of going to school are not being helped. Many people who can be the next generation to be entrepreneurs are not having the opportunity. They feel lost. Africa is a country where people need to be educated as well. Sometimes the solution is not to go away. Sometimes you can find your way where you are. We need to understand that you have poor people in America and you have poor people in Africa. It's not only, the solution is not just USA. My son have dreams about that. His dreams was the solution is USA. And he wanted to come here. He came here. But I believe that if had Amadou was given the chance, he would have been a very, very successful man. We have problems here, but we do have problems at home as well. So if you look at the outside in, there's no perfect solution here.
There are problems, but there are also opportunities.
Absolutely. Look at, there's a young man who came here from Mali who was working for NASA. And many, many people came here. There's another young man who came from Senegal with just $20 in his pocket. And they found the biggest corporation today to give energy to Africa. People, if they are given the chance, they can work hard and succeed. This is why the Amadou Diallo Foundation is focusing on this exchange program, exchange opportunity between Africa and the U.S. We have built a little computer lab in Guinea, giving the necessary skills to young people there in place. And we are also trying to help sponsor some students from the U.S. so that they can see Africa by their own eyes, and maybe they can have opportunity there as well.
Guinea-Conakry, I'll go to Tanzania. Good evening, Victoria from Tanzania. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Chakasali. How are you?
I am hugely terrific. How are you today?
I'm very good. My question seems to be like the one which happened. And my question is, I'm asking my brothers and sisters in America, that do they ever look back to what is happening in Africa? And do they ever think that they are in the better position than us? And not to use violence and to use maybe other ways of going up, because they are in the system already. We have no system here. So my question is, do they have to use the same methods we are using in Africa and America?
Very interesting.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting. Especially... You, madam, given that, of course, you are a recent immigrant from Guinea-Conakry, and, of course, you just had elections in Guinea over the weekend. Were there, in fact, elections or selections?
Let me say that in the U.S., Guinean people, we are many here. We have different NGOs. I'm involved in one of the NGOs that called Justice in Guinea, and we have a website also. We do outreach weekly radio in my native tongue, Fulani, to people who immigrated here to educate them how they can be involved in the system to help bring change. Mm. I think Guinea is a young country. We have lots of problems. In fact, 2009, we marched to the Capitol. We marched to the White House, and we went to the Justice Department to claim that there are imbalanced system in Guinea, and we need help. You know, Africa is system here in America, and the system in Africa is different, of course. But we will get there through education. We will get there. Here, what I learned, and I will let him speak also, we have what they call the civil rights movement before, like Dr. King initiated people to do peaceful demonstration to bring about change. This is what I believe should happen in Guinea and elsewhere. In Guinea, people, for instance, if someone, like brothers, can fight because they don't support the same candidate, that's wrong. The fundamental problem we have in Guinea today is how, like you say, we will start from selecting a president to voting and counting the vote to be counted.
You talk about how young Guinea-Conakry is, but let's face it, you got your independence back in 1958, the last time I checked.
Yes.
And you had, of course...
That's still pretty young.
Well, you know...
Considering us, we're 1776.
You had the great Sekou Toure who said no to the goal.
Yes, and we became very proud. In fact, it's in my book, My Heart Will Cross This Ocean. We talk about... how we used to be proud, and we tell the French people, yes, you should go, we can be, you know, the revolution. You know Malcolm X?
Oh, yes.
Sekou Toure was his idol. And I think if Malcolm and the brother Harry Belafonte also, J.C. Jackson, Belafonte, all of them went to Guinea.
Stokely Carmichael.
Exactly, Stokely Carmichael. All of them.
Miriam Makeba.
Guinea was the paramount pivotal for them to be proud and black here, one of them. One of the leaders was Sekou Toure, who inspired them.
A great friend
to French people and survive. But then he mismanaged. Yes?
A great friend of the Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana himself?
Yes.
Very interesting. But at the same time, Guinea also, frankly, seems to be like one of the capitals of dictatorship
Let me tell you this. I'm pleading anyone who is watching our show right now, because it's Africa Talk Live. Guinea is in the verge of civil war. If I heard that tomorrow we're having civil war, I will not be surprised. We need to stop this.
Really?
We do not want Guinea to become like Rwanda.
Like Rwanda?
Yes.
You know what is going on, of course, in the Burundi.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure you've been following what is going on in Uganda.
Yes.
Have you seen the police?
Yes, yes.
Undressing a lady?
Oh.
You know, I think that one of the ways that, and she said that Guinea is not there yet, but the United States of America, again, is a constitutional republic. We're a nation of laws. We're based on that constitution. And because of that constitution and all the unassailable rights granted to U.S. citizens under that constitution.
Apartheid South Africa would have told you exactly the same thing.
Well, this place is a little different because it guaranteed the constitution and all the amendments to the constitution guaranteed fair and equal rights for all. And then the Civil Rights Act also guaranteed there would not be discrimination against people of
color. And this didn't happen until the Civil Rights?
Well, regarding the discrimination.
In the 50s, really, almost at the same time as when a lot of African countries themselves also gained independence. Well, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Kadiatou Diarro, the founder and president of the Amadou Diarro Foundation, the mother of a slain Guinean immigrant killed by four New York police officers in February 1999, and Dagara Sloan, executive committee member of the DC NAACP. Thanks to our field stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.